This is Squawk Pod. I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today on our podcast, who says big cities are over? Motorcycle club member, and billionaire real estate mogul Sam Zell says the exodus to suburban pandemic retreats is temporary. Cities will rise again.
Urbanization, you know, creates both challenges and opportunities, isn't about to change.
Welcome, class of 2024, to your bedrooms. Georgetown University's president on a very unorthodox fall semester.
We estimated nearly half of the students we were bringing to campus, half being quarantined for those first 2 weeks. We made a decision that we would go fully virtual at the start of this year.
Those stories, plus more details about Palantir's hotly anticipated Wall Street debut as the company's S-1 is released.
It's almost a sort of a right-leaning version of wokeness.
And the Trump case for re-election in prime time.
He's what is best for our country.
It's Wednesday, August 26th, 2020. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Good morning. Welcome back to Squawk Box right here on CNBC. I'm Andrew Ross Sorkin, along with Joe Kernan. And Melissa Lee is with us today. Becky's off. Melissa, welcome to to the club this morning.
It's great to be here. It's always great to start the morning with you guys.
She's like a regular.
I say that without a hint of sarcasm.
Yeah, that's a
She's
first.
Looking at her watch. She's looking at her first. Watch. Yeah. She's like, it's 6 o'clock in the morning. What am I doing here?
She's a regular. I mean, she's, you're happy to be. I don't know. Sometimes you got to really tell us what, because you like it. You know, you may feign a little bit of, oh boy, it's early and everything, but you're ready to play and you show. And you show them. And,
always. It's, you know, important. You got to bring it each time. You never know.
You do. No I in team. No I in team. And you're here. And we're glad
to have you. There's only a me.
There's only a me. I always say that. It's an M, really. I guess it's a me. Anyway. All right.
First up, new details on one of the most anticipated public debuts of the last few years. Data analytics company Palantir Technologies has released its prospectus to debut on the public markets. In the filing, Palantir revealed that it plans to list on the New York Stock Exchange under the ticker PLTR and will pursue a direct listing rather than a traditional IPO. The same unconventional route has been taken by Slack in 2019 and Spotify in 2018. The company said it lost about $580 million last year, despite a 25% increase in revenue from the prior year. Palantir was founded in 2003 by a group of Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, including CEO Alex Karp and Peter Thiel. Thiel became wealthy as a founder of PayPal and an early investor in Facebook. And just in case you didn't know, I did not until today, Palantir, the company, was named after a magical orb in The Lord of the Rings that lets you travel across vast distances. Here's Andrew Ross Sorkin with more.
In the filing, CEO Alex Karp said, quote, "Our company was founded in Silicon Valley." And by the way, now it goes to take on a shot at Silicon Valley, but we seem to share fewer and fewer of the technology sector's values and commitments. From the start, we have repeatedly turned down opportunities to sell, collect, or mine data. Other technology companies, including some of the largest in the world, have built their entire businesses on doing just that. Karp recently announced plans to move its headquarters from Palo Alto to Denver, in part because of this value issue he's talked about. Palantir also clear on its stance on China. He says, "We do not work with the Chinese Communist Party and have chosen not to host our platforms in China, which may limit our growth prospects." The company proposed three classes of stock, Class A, Class B, and Class F, which will be held by a voting trust established by its founders, including Peter Thiel, with just below 50% of the total voting power for that stock. That's similar to the voting structure of other tech giants, including Facebook and Google. So if you're concerned about the power structure, that is something they do share in common with the rest of the Valley. But Alex Karp has been on our program several times now, has been critical of Silicon Valley over the years. But most interestingly, given that it's a data-driven company itself, insofar as it's collecting data from all over the world on behalf of corporations, and in large part, this was a company that was built on the back, or I shouldn't say on the back, but in the aftermath of 9/11 to help the U.S. government track down terrorists, and doing so through data. It's an interesting position that he's now taken related to how what he would describe as, I think, the commercial internet giants, how they use data relative to the way Palantir does.
It's kind of a new version of woke, what he's saying. He's like, it's almost a sort of a right-leaning version of wokeness. I mean, you could imagine that the truly woke people in Silicon Valley look down on this company because of all the work it does with the CIA, and we know those are a bunch of nasty, horrible people, and defense contractors, and all these people in the military complex that you know are sort of working against wokeness, you would think. And instead, they're attacking all the really PC companies for really stealing all of our privacy data and selling it. So it's kind of a reverse wokeness. I like it, and it's I think it,
there
part
is
of Peter
a reverse
Thiel.
Wokeness.
It's kind of Peter Thiel's
of
deal.
Sorts.
Yeah.
I should note Alex is a I think he would say he's a self-defined libertarian, very much in Peter Thiel in that regard.
Yeah.
However, he is, in fairness, given that we're in the midst of a convention in the middle of an election, he has been publicly against this administration and President Trump, despite the government contracts that the company
still,
has.
Still, from, yes. and, from a political perspective, it's much smarter for the company to say, you know what, China, we're going to pass on your business right now, especially considering how dependent they are on federal contracts. So if they're working for the military, they're working for the CIA, you can't also host servers and get data from China. I mean, you're sort of forced to pick sides in this particular instance. And some people will slam it because they're saying, you know, you're going to forgo future profits. But for right now, this is probably what they do in order to preserve their pipeline for the next few years.
And Andrew, it's not like they're do what I say. I mean, in terms of voting interest in the way you structure the company, they aren't really setting the standard for egalitarian corporate governance. I mean, they know exactly who's going to be controlling the company, right? I mean, they got a structure where the owners are in total control. So that's kind of not that woke. So there, it's kind of an enigma, isn't it?
Yeah, but I would say he's an interesting guy. And we, as you know, we've talked to him many times. And he's a very principled guy, has sort of very clear principles. But I think his biggest takeaway right now is his frustration with the Valley insofar as, you know, when Google decided not to pursue the Maven project and when you saw Amazon move away from the government, I think his view is actually that the American people would actually have a much greater acceptance of perhaps some of the data collection and other things that the companies do, the things that may not be, that some people may not perceive as positive, if that there was a positive benefit on the other end of these companies helping the country in that way. And so he's always trying to push the push the conversation in various directions.
Well, it's a cool name.
We'll see. What would be very curious to me, though, is sort of how this company gets valued in the public markets. It does still lose money. It's an enterprise company, but it's not, and it's a SaaS company. There's very high capital costs. If you look through some of these filings early on in terms of when they first get a client, they've got to do oftentimes a lot of white glove work to get it to work with the client. So a big government client or a big corporate client, there's a lot. But once they do, the idea is, are they locked in? Meaning, is that client, can that client really go anywhere because all of that work's been done? So we're going to see how investors value that.
I don't want to use this precious time attacking the other side, because as we saw last week, that kind of talk only serves to divide the country further. I'm here because we need my husband to be our president and commander-in-chief for 4 more years. He's what is best for our country.
First Lady Melania Trump making the case in a live speech from the White House Rose Garden during the second night of the revamped 2020 Republican National Convention. Mrs. Trump was among the first speakers over the two evenings to directly address the uncertainty surrounding the coronavirus pandemic, the administration's handling of which will surely be on voters' minds November 3rd. But the campaign for re-election has highlighted the strong American economy leading into 2020. Here's National Economic Council Director Larry Kudlow in his RNC remarks.
Our economic choice is very clear. Do you want economic health, prosperity, opportunity, and optimism? Or do you want to turn back to the dark days of stagnation, recession, and pessimism? I believe there can't be better economic policies than we've had in recent years. So I say, stay with them.
The battleground states serious concerns about COVID-19 on the decline as President Trump's approval rating is moving higher. Eamon Javers is standing by right now with the latest results from CNBC's Change Research States of Play survey. Eamon, great to see you this morning.
Yeah, Andrew, that's right. We are seeing that bump here for President Trump, and it has to do with the fact that people feel a little bit better about the economy, a little bit better about the virus, all of that improvement translating into good news for the president. The COVID response improvement is really what's driving that spike in his overall job approval. So the president there, not back to where he was, but certainly rebounding a little bit. Now look at the serious concerns about COVID. They are lessening. 66% of the respondents here in these battleground states told us they had serious concerns. That compares to 87% back in April. That's good news for the president as that panic feeling starts to lessen and people learn to figure out how to live with this. But overall, still, in terms of who would have a better job of handling the coronavirus, the edge does go to Joe Biden and the Democrats, 51% to 49% for Donald Trump and the Republicans. And in this poll, Andrew, we also see that Joe Biden has an edge in every one of those swing states that we're looking at. We're looking at six different swing states across the country. We're looking at likely voters here. These are the people we think will actually show up or participate in the voting. Biden has an edge there, but it's a narrow one, and the president is certainly getting a boost over the past week or so. Back over to you.
All right, Eamon. Yep, thank you. Were you up? I mean, you got to be, right? Eamon, you had to watch. You're there.
Yeah, I'm operating on not very much sleep, yeah.
You are? You can do it. It's only a week.
It's only 1 week. Well, we did last week, and we're doing this week.
Right. It could be worse. You could be watching, you know, NBA or something like. I'm a little tired too from that. Anyway,
could be worse. We could have three political parties.
That's right. We could.
Next on Squawk Pod, billionaire investor and real estate magnate Sam Zell on this polarizing election season.
I think that the real $64 question in this whole election is, who is Joe Biden? Is Joe Biden the Joe Biden of 20 years ago, or is the Joe Biden just a placeholder for the Democratic Party?
We're back after this. This is Squawk Pod from CNBC. Our next conversation is with billionaire real estate titan Sam Zell. He's the chairman of Equity Group Investments. If you've ever lived in an equity residential building in Chicago or New York, that's the same company. He's a self-proclaimed professional opportunist and grave dancer, meaning he's always spotting and cashing in on other people's mistakes. And he's been doing that with that moniker since the 1970s. Zell is also famous for colorful language. He's not shy. He wrote a book called Am I Being Too Subtle? All about his communication and investing philosophies. And to answer that question, no, Sam, not too subtle at all. This knack for not mincing words is part of why we look forward to his interviews on Squawk Box, especially when the country, the world, and our economy feel so polarized. Right now, the state of Sam Zell's real estate realm feels precarious as big offices move to remote work indefinitely and urban renters move to the suburbs. While some, like Jerry Seinfeld for the New York Times, believe that iconic cities like New York will never die, others aren't so sure. There are 13,000 empty apartments in Manhattan right now, a record high. Here's Joe Kernan kicking off Squawk's conversation with Sam Zell.
I want to start by asking you, right now it seems like you'd be looking around and seeing so many opportunities, given that so many things were being left, were so undervalued given what happened with the economy during the pandemic. But you don't see it that way. You're not buying anything right now, are you?
Well, we are for sure active, although it's really too early for what I would call the normal clearing process. And that clearing process usually leads to opportunities. And I think everybody is still a little bit shaken, and I think people haven't made decisions yet or haven't been confronted with the reality of the situation. So I think that there will be significant opportunities probably in the fourth quarter or the first quarter of next year. But the overall, the pandemic has basically slowed down decision making and deferred decision making, and therefore the general activity level from a transaction point of view is much less at this point.
The big cities Sam. I think maybe you might be more pessimistic than really a lot of people. And I do want to, now that I read this out, let's run this Barry Sternlicht side, because he points out some of the issues that people see. Here it is, and you can respond.
There's hundreds of thousands of people looking for suburban homes. And I would say it's not as driven by the COVID situation as it is safety and law and order. And that is now pervasive across the big cities of the United States, sadly.
You've characterized the future of big city, I guess, both office and residential as long-lasting scars in that sector of real estate. Do you feel that way? Could you go into that a little bit, Sam?
Yes. I think Barry's comments are exactly right, and that is that everybody is being driven and impacted by the issues of safety. And I think that we're in kind of an early stage of kind of, let's call it a change. You can see it here in Chicago. I think Chicago was surprised by the violence and the looting and the organized nature of the attacks. The steps that they have taken since that time have been very significant in terms of for lack of a better word, gaining or regaining control of the city. I think that's happening pretty much all over the country. I think that, yes, people are, quote, running to the suburbs, particularly to find, rental kind of housing. But I think that's a short-term response. And I think that the basic reasons for cities, the fact that we're social animals, the fact that urbanization, creates both challenges and opportunities, isn't about to change. And I don't think we're going to see anything like a repeat back to the bad old days where cities were too dangerous. Now, we obviously need a lot of enforcement, and we need a lot of adjustment to these no bail, no bad things happening. There have to be consequences, and hopefully we'll see that happen in the next few months.
Well, we'll see. I was thinking about how long you've been coming on the show, and you've spanned a lot of different administrations. And I don't know, it must be 20 years probably that you've been coming on the show.
Yeah,
anyway,
I think so. It's been a long time.
Yeah. Anyway, I remember
when, Joe Kernan was a young guy.
Yeah. Very funny. You've looked the same the entire time. Somehow, which is that's good and bad, Sam. No, I'm kidding. Check this out. So you always say that you have been a Democrat for life. You've always been a Democrat. But there have been times in the past, I'd say mostly during the Obama-Biden administration, where I think that you criticize some of the regulations, the regulatory environment, maybe some of the tax policy. And I'm just wondering where you are right now, given that we're in political season. There's a piece in the Wall Street Journal. It says that the left and Mr. Biden want to claim that Trump inherited a long expansion, but they point out it was the weakest recovery post-war, and that the second half of 2015 was losing steam and came close to a recession in 2016, and then the policies that Trump brought in, the deregulation, the tax cuts, the corporate tax cuts, really did work initially until COVID came along. Do you agree with that, that things were going along pretty well? And what do you think we need, what should we do? Which policies in the future from where we are right now make more sense to bring the economy back? Tax hikes or more of what we saw?
Well, first of all, I do agree. I never really identified myself as a Democrat in the most recent periods. In the beginning, when I was very young and in school and in law school, etc., I was for sure a Democrat. As I've gotten older, I've been much more of an independent and probably a Republican. I was critical of the Obama-Biden era because I don't believe that redistribution is the solution for anything. The only thing that really matters is growth, and that what the United States needs to do is encourage growth. And that's how we also solve the inequality problem. I think that inequality grew dramatically during the Obama years, primarily because the focus was on redistribution rather than on creating growth opportunities. I think that many of the things that the Trump administration did were very positive for that. Hopefully they will continue and help get us out of this mess from the pandemic.
Hey, Sam, you talked about not seeing opportunities until maybe later this year. And I'm wondering if you think there are opportunities on the other side of the trade. There's been a lot of talk recently of billionaire investors going short the CMBS 6 series, which is heavily weighted towards mall debt. Is there more downside in that sort of trade? Are you in or have you considered that sort of trade?
I'm very lucky. I used to be one of the largest owners of retail in the United States. Long time ago, in the early 90s, I decided that that wasn't where I ought to be focused and sold our entire retail portfolio. I obviously wasn't smart enough to know that online retail was coming on and what it was going to do to the retail market. But there's little question in my mind that retail is a falling knife. And we are for sure not at the bottom in terms of the impact online and the just change in the orientation toward retail.
So there is more pain. And have you considered that sort of a trade where you're betting against that debt, you're betting will go into default?
Yeah, I don't really think in terms of trades. I think in terms of, you know, would I buy a retail portfolio today? Maybe not today, but maybe tomorrow. I think that, we started out this whole scenario with more retail space per person than any country in the world by a multiple. So to some extent, the change in retail is really just a recognition of the oversupply. I think going forward, certainly the pandemic has accelerated the amount of online retail, and I don't think that's ever going to change. And it's going to require, future retail to be retail real estate to be very different than it has been up until now.
Sam, yesterday we played the side of Barry Sternlicht. He had a lot of worries about law and order, big cities and everything. But when pressed, he thought that the divisiveness of the last 4 years, if he had to be pushed on who he would vote for this time around, he finally came out with a Biden. We've asked you we go back many, many years, and you are always hesitant. You don't endorse on TV, and I'm not sure you're ready to do it this time. But
that's correct.
Okay. You do have some pretty stark choices in terms of regulatory policy, probably in terms of, I don't know, Green New Deals, in terms of tax hikes, things like that. Can you give me some body language as to which way does the divisiveness or the downside to what people see in Donald Trump make it unable for you to support him for 4 more years?
I think that as an investor and as an American citizen, I don't think anything is, quote, as clear as the way you perceive the question. I think that the real $64 question in this whole election is, who is Joe Biden? And is Joe Biden the Joe Biden of 20 years ago? Or is the Joe Biden just a placeholder for the Democratic Party being taken over by the radical left? I think that the ideas of what I'll call, for lack of a better word, the radical left are relatively catastrophic for the future of our country. And I'm not supportive of them. If Joe Biden, quote, is able to govern from the center, that's a very different story. And I think that over the next 3 months, we're going to find out exactly where he stands and whether he has the commitment to being a centrist or whether he's just going to be run over.
What was Obama Biden? Was that administration? Was that centrist? Would you like that? Would you like that Biden for the next 4 years?
Well, let's put it like this. If you told me that the Obama-Biden plan or methodologies was going to be repeated for the next 4 years, I would be a lot less worried than I am right now.
Okay. All right. So you're worried about it going... So what I'm reading is you didn't like the redistribution policies of the 8 years of Obama-Biden, but it's preferable to the divisiveness or some of the downside to the Trump years.
Obviously, don't think that the divisiveness is beneficial. And I think that anything that is, you know, focused on dividing our country is not a positive thing. At the same time, I think some of the radical solutions and free everything philosophies are just not realistic and ultimately will lead to the destruction of our economic system.
Okay. Andrew, do you want in?
We're all good. And Sam, it's great to see you. And it's fascinating to hear your views, both the political views, but also your views about cities. And I'm trying to be optimistic and hopeful. I hope that you know, 6 months from now, a year from now, that some of the great cities like Chicago, your city, and New York return to some better sense of normalcy. So I appreciate your optimism this morning.
And I think I would add by saying that it's going to require leadership. You know, it's going to require the leaders of all the companies to come back to their offices and lead the people and create the opportunity. And hiding out in the Hamptons or hiding out in Vermont or wherever doesn't make any sense and is counterproductive.
All right, Sam, great to have you on today. We will continue our long, long relationship, hopefully.
My pleasure. I miss being there in person and connecting as we usually did.
Coming up, will college ever be the same? Georgetown's president on containing COVID, virtual learning, and getting in.
We aren't expecting much change in terms of the interest in students applying to the university, but we're in a very new moment, and I think we're all learning, and we're going to see just what unfolds.
Squawk Pod will be right back. You're listening to Squawk Pod.
Good morning and welcome back to Squawk Box here on CNBC. I'm Joe Kernel along with Andrew Ross Sorkin and Melissa Lee. Becky is off today.
Georgetown University's fall semester starts today, virtually, that is. They were one of the many colleges who reversed their original plans in late July after cases rose across the country. Joining us now, John DeGioia, president of Georgetown University. Jack, great to see you. Thank you for joining us.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you.
How difficult was this decision and how do you think about sort of the longer term impact on the Georgetown community, particularly when you don't have first-year students having the benefit of that sort of culture on campus?
It's one of the great questions that we're engaged in right now. Our decision took place over the course of roughly 2 months. We began our preparations back in April for this fall, but in early June, we made a decision that we would be able to reopen. We would need to do so monitoring carefully the public health conditions here in this region. And we made a decision at that point that we're going to try to bring back a good part of our community, our graduate students, our law students, our medical students, our research community. And we're going to hold off the decision on undergraduates, just trying to determine what would be the right framework for bringing back undergraduates. We have a very dense, very, very rich a residential experience. Nearly 90% of our undergraduates live right here on the Georgetown campus. At the end of June, early July, we informed our undergraduates that we were going to bring back the first year students. We were going to bring to campus our first year students, and we'd hold off. We'd see how that would go before we would make a decision to bring back any more. But as you were just describing, the accelerating pace of the spread of the virus through July made those plans impossible. At the end of July, we were looking at uncontrolled spread in nearly 30 states and restrictions on interstate travel. And as we looked at that, the city of Washington made a decision that anyone coming from any of 27 states would be required to be quarantined for 14 days. And we estimated nearly half of the students we were bringing to campus would have to be in quarantine for those first 2 weeks. And we looked at just the conditions that we were wrestling with and how it was unfolding. And we made a decision that we would go fully virtual at the start of this year.
I mean, logistically, for a lot of urban-centric universities, it's difficult to find the space to actually quarantine students before they get onto campus officially, let alone if there is any sort of an outbreak. You know, it's interesting because the semester is starting as sort of high school seniors are considering where to apply to for college for next year. And I'm wondering what you expect in terms of the admissions process. A lot of the students that have decided to matriculate at universities this year for their first year, they had made the decision to go before schools reversed on not bringing them back to campus. Do you expect any sort of a drop off in applications, particularly when you're talking about spending $56,000 a year on tuition? It's hard to say $56,000 a year for online learning.
Yes, and as you may know, we did make a decision when we went fully virtual for our undergraduates to reduce our tuition. We provide such an engaged residential experience, and we've built such an infrastructure to support that. We know that infrastructure is not going to be used this fall, so we made some adjustments to the cost of education for this fall. You know, our sense, we haven't seen any real change. We've had a few more, I'd say, you know, a larger number of students requested a leave of absence after we made a decision to go fully virtual, but the numbers weren't significant. And we aren't expecting much change in terms of the interest in students applying to the university. But we're in a very new moment, and I think we're all learning, and we're going to see just what unfolds as we move into this new academic year.
No sports at Georgetown. What are you expecting with other universities? You are on the board, I believe, the NCAA.
Yes, yes. Well, this fall, our conferences, we participate in two conferences. The Big East, for almost all of our sports, we play football in the Patriot League. And in mid-August, both conferences announced that we would be postponing fall sports, and we would be moving them to the spring in the hope that we'll be able to have our fall sports this spring. And an unusual, but nevertheless, we're hopeful to be able to move that forward for the spring. So we don't have intercollegiate athletic competition taking place this fall. And I think you would see that across much of higher education. The NCAA recommendations regarding healthcare have made it very clear what kinds of conditions would ideally be in place for us to be able to engage in intercollegiate athletics. And then the guidance from the board in August was the NCAA, right, whose fundamental responsibility in the fall is to host the championships, if less than half of those who would be eligible to participate in NCAA championships in the fall were not participating in their conference activities, then the NCAA would not have fall championships. And in fact, more than half of our conferences across the nation are not competing this fall. So there will not be NCAA football, NCAA championship in all sports this fall.
Sure. Jack, great to see you. Thanks for your time.
Jack
DeGioia, Georgetown University.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
That's Squawk Pod for today. Thanks for listening. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Thanks to Melissa Lee for sitting in today.
Melissa, parting is such sweet sorrow. Are you here tomorrow?
I'll see you tomorrow.
Good. Excellent. Andrew, you too.
Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 a.m. Eastern and subscribe to Squawk Pod wherever you get your podcasts. Tweet us questions or comments at Squawk CNBC, and we'll meet you back here tomorrow.